And now on RTE Radio 1, Arts Tonight with Vincent Woods.
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. On the programme, art and history, singing, painting and writing, Irish revolt and revolution.
What need you, being come to sense, but fumble in a greasy till and add a halfpence to the pence and prayer to shivering prayer until you've dried the marrow from the bone? For men were born to pray and save. Romantic Ireland's dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave. Yet they were of a different kind, the names that stilled your childish play. They have gone about the world like wind, but little time had they to pray for whom the hangman's rope was spun, and what, God help us, could they save? Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, it's with O'Leary in the grave.
The voice of William Butler Yeats there with his celebrated poem September 1913. That poem helps provide the title to the current exhibition at the Hugh Lane Dublin City Gallery in Parnell Square in Dublin. Dublin Divided September 1913 presents a striking selection of the gallery's work, including portraits of many of the leading figures of 1913, Larkin, Connolly and William Martin Murphy among them, as well as images of working life, striking workers and watercolour images of the Municipal Gallery of Hugh Lane's dreams. Later we'll visit the Dublin City Gallery, the Hugh Lane, and talk to Margarita Capock, curator of that exhibition, and to Emer O'Connor, author of the book Sean Keating, Art, Politics and Building the Irish Nation. But first, to consider how art can and does illuminate history, and in the context of this programme, that means the history of Ireland a century ago, I'm joined by Katrina Crowe, Head of Special Collections at the National Archives, poet Theo Dorgan, who has written the preface to a new book, Songs of Freedom, the James Connolly Songbook, edited by Matt Callaghan, and Paul Rouse of the School of History and Archives at UCD, who's also a director of the Century Ireland Project. Katrina Crowe, I suppose it's been a rich and busy year in terms of the arts, remembering and seeking to illuminate our history. The Hugh Lane exhibition, one part of that and a very fine part of it. But it's also been a very interesting year in terms of theatre.
It has. And we are looking forward now to the new production of The Risen People in the Abbey, directed by Jimmy Fay, which is going to be exciting, I think, particularly because of a lot of the new music that's going to be in it. There were, of course, songs in the original productions, but there are new ones added in, and I think probably some of what Theo will have to say will play into that. But I think that there's been a lot of theatre going on over the year, some of it very good amateur theatre, some of it semi-professional, like Anne Matthews' play Lockout, which appeared in the new theatre. But for me, certainly, the most interesting and relevant has been a new production's two outings, the first one being Living the Lockout, which was site-specifically staged in a tenement building in Henrietta Street, which, of course, was one of the most overcrowded streets, full of child mortality, lack of sanitation, all the rest of the horrors that went with the slums back in 1913. Now, what Anu does is quite new to Dublin, in the sense that one of the things that many people might have seen would have been Laundry, where they took us into the old Magdalen Laundry.
Wonderful in, piece of theatre.
Which was absolutely sensational in Sean McDermott Street. They interrogate history with great subtlety, great compassion. They're not trying to make cheap propagandist points ever. And in Living the Lockout, for example, we got exposed to a number of different sides of the dilemma that faced working people at the time. So you've got two brothers, one of whom is married with two children, and a younger brother who's a firebrand, who's single and who's quite happy to keep going on when the other guy gives in because his children are starving. We also get the wife of that young man with her two children in a room with the children in bed, and she's meditating on what is she going to do? She's pawned everything that she's got. The only thing left is the bed. And this had such an effect on some of the members of the audience. There were 378 performances that on several occasions somebody said, usually a woman, don't sell the bed, love, I'll give you the money. Now, it's the glass wall is gone, the proscenium arch is gone. You are in the middle of the production. And they went on then to do a series of 13 highly ambitious people, 13 different segments dealing with the lockout, among which was an extraordinary not recreation of the Asquith Tribunal, which I was always very interested in having somebody stage during the year because it's such an obvious thing to do. This was the Tribunal of Inquiry into Bloody Sunday and the general grievances that both unions and employers had, which found in favour of James Larkin. But instead of giving us a sort of classically staged reenactment of the tribunal, they put us into a room in Dublin Castle with having, and this is Louise Lowe's genius, she had actually shot an hour-long video of the actual tribunal with Bosco Hogan, the wonderful Bosco Hogan playing William Martin Murphy, and a sensational young actor called Jed Murray playing Larkin, who's a real discovery and who's the most convincing Larkin I've seen in a very long time.
Something I want to ask you, did you feel, watching the Anu productions in particular, did you feel that you learned something about that period? And I mean, you would be one of the people in this country who knows most about it, but did you feel that you got a deeper insight through what they were doing?
I feel I got two serious things. One, inside the characters' heads in a way that no history book can bring you there, with all due respect to historians who, of course, are wonderful people. But it's not the same as that interior experience that you get when you're right in the middle of somebody's home experiencing it. Also, stuff like Larkin's strain and agony at the point when the Asquith Tribunal came up was vividly represented by Jed Murray watching this video himself. So they're very quick to use new things. The other thing they do is constantly, and this is a theme of the year, and it's very important to highlight the fact that the trade union movement really, really went to the pin of its collar this year to use art as a way of getting its message across. And the message, of course, is that all these years later, we still do not have a statutory right to free collective bargaining. We're told the Labour Party are going to give it to us next year. But that was hammered home all the time as being a hangover from the past that has to be addressed at some point soon. And theatre did it brilliantly.
Theodore Organ, somebody who would have been very interested in that whole issue, free collective bargaining, James Connolly, and this new book, Songs of Freedom, James Connolly songbook, a very handsome publication, an American publisher. You've written the preface, and tell me about what's contained in there and about Connolly's own work as a songwriter.
Well, Connolly was a curious man in the sense that unlike perhaps the generation of Labour leaders who came over him, he realised that he actually wanted revolution, which nobody has since, no matter what people say. We have a lot of the rhetoric of it. But he said, I think in 1909, that the Irish are not a revolutionary people. They couch their democratic demands in revolutionary language, and they insist on attempting to make their revolutions according to the rule book. So he had no illusions there. But he understood that song and story is as much a weapon of the transformation of consciousness as the most carefully reasoned political tract or the most rousing political speech. In early 1916 in The Irish Worker, he talks about having had a most pleasant experience of having afternoon tea with Lady Gregory and W.B. Yeats. And he thought they were sound on the essential questions, he said.
Which good
was
to know.
A very judicious thing. But he felt that he understood something that, it touches on something Katrina brought up there. Something happens to us when we consider political questions in a spirit of togetherness, that's to say, en masse. And one of the ways in which we awaken ourselves is by singing together. It's a profoundly human thing. And he felt that the workers' revolution movement needed songs. And the first songbook he put together, he did it in the United States, in fact. And in this book, The lyrics and the musical notation is reproduced, and Labour is always spelled minus the U in the first collection. This brings together three collections of songs. The first collection, he wrote very little of it himself. Mostly it was gathered in from other people. And then he began to write songs himself for The Irish Worker. And it was interesting that he felt it was completely necessary to reach out to writers especially. But, you know, he had an awareness of all of the arts. He had an awareness of theatre, for instance. And he understood that politics is a totalising thing. It involves the whole person. You know, Rosa Luxemburg's famous phrase, bread and roses, has a resonance for people.
And in your preface, you say that you think Connolly would really appreciate that concept.
I think he would. I think he would understand, for instance, that, you know, 200 yards from the GPO is the acid test of what the Republic became or did not become. And the poverty in Dublin's north inner city and the sense of being excluded by the state was every bit as profound up into the 1980s, and some would argue now, as it was When those women were knocking at the door, at the windows of the GPO, looking for their soldiers' pensions during Easter week.
What did his songs address, you know, when he went to write? And I think in some cases he took old tunes.
The difficult bit with all of this is Connolly was not one of nature's gifted lyricists. And to the modern ear, I think the lyric comes across as maybe stilted and formulaic. But it's in the language of the times as well. And some of it is surprisingly still vivid. He, for instance, the be moderate. Here's a verse. Our masters all, a godly crew, whose hearts throb for the poor. Their sympathies assure us, too, if our demands were fewer. Most generous souls, but please observe what they enjoy from birth is all we ever had the nerve to ask, that is, the earth. Now, it has a certain contemporary resonance, wouldn't you say? It's actually, that's written to the air of a nation once again. One of the things Connolly did, which was very smart, is he wrote new words to well-known tunes. But what he was after was something that perhaps in contemporary writing we don't often remember. You'll see it at a Demian Dempsey gig or a Christy Moore gig. When people are singing together and when they're singing about things that matter to them, something happens. The heart is strengthened, but also the imagination opens out and you begin to think, but maybe this is just possible. There's something about the awakening of that collective spirit that singing together to a common purpose brings.
Paul Rouse, an interesting point you make is that art and history are sometimes linked in unexpected ways, ways that, that may be forgotten almost. You know, Sean O'Casey writing a history of the Irish Citizen Army, for example, or Joe Connor's fine account of Charlie Donnelly and Even the Olives Are Bleeding. As writers addressing history in a very direct way, not looking at it through a prism of fiction or theatre.
Well, if you look at what Sean O'Casey wrote in his History of the Irish Citizen Army, which was written in 1919, at least published in 1919, it was in many respects a justification of his own involvement and his own departure from that movement, because he left it in 1914 when James Connolly began to move the Irish Citizen Army into closer alignment with the Irish Volunteers. And as far as O'Casey was concerned, this was a serious mistake, that what he would see, what he saw as inevitably going to happen was the manner in which Irish nationalism would swallow Irish labour and that the cause of labour would be left behind. I don't fully agree, I suppose, with Theo on what he says when he quotes James Connolly about revolution and the Irish not being given to revolution. I mean, history shows that they are given to revolution. Oh, but it's a nationalist revolution, not a social revolution.
Well, it's maybe interesting to consider all of that through the prism of the arts, which is what we're trying to do here. And I just wonder, do you ever, as an historian, look to history through the arts? I mean, would you read a novel? Would you look at paintings? Would you read poems or listen to songs and think that you might gain that sort of layer of insight that we were talking about with Katrina through seeing the Anu production? Would you ever think in that way, or do you prefer to rely on more standard texts, you know, on the manuscripts, on the letters, on journalism, and on more, I suppose, standard sources?
I think it would be a really poor historian who wouldn't look to the arts for certain insights into history. You look back at the poetry, the plays, the works of literature that were written, and you gain a new understanding of history. There's a brilliant book written by William Irwin Thompson, published in the late 1960s, a controversial book called The Imagination of an Insurrection, and it looks at how literature fed into Irish history and brought about a rising. Now, he probably oversteps himself, and he was roundly condemned after it was published. There were review upon review heaping criticism on his work. For example, in the Irish University Review, Robert Hogan wrote that this was not an important book or even a good one. But he did admit that Thompson had an idea in there and that most books don't have ideas in there. And his idea was to look at how history, he combined history and literary criticism to give an insight into why a rising took place. And he kind of crystallised it in a phrase in the introduction when he said, the Irish revolutionaries lived as if they were in a work of art. And this inability to tell the difference between sober reality and the realm of imagination is perhaps one very important characteristic of a revolutionary.
And it's very interesting because he was writing that in the late 60s. And in a way, what he was doing then seems very much to have been ahead of its time. I want to talk a little bit more about that book later, Paul. And obviously, we have a great deal more to talk about. But before that, we've been to the Municipal Gallery, the Hugh Lane in Parnell Square in Dublin, to see the Dublin Divided exhibition there. And curator Dr. Margarita Capock told me about the inspiration for it.
Well, this exhibition opened at the end of September and it's called Dublin Divided, September 1913. And it's an exhibition that commemorates the lockout of 1913, but also the year 1913 was a very momentous year in terms of the establishment of the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. And it's one in which the events of 1913 had huge repercussions, not only for the city of Dublin, but also for the foundation of this modern art gallery in Dublin.
So it's very much about all of the history of the time. It's not simply the lockout. It's also the artistic history, the development of this particular art gallery as well.
Well, the interesting thing about this art gallery and its foundation is that its history is very much interwoven with the lockout. And that's something that maybe people aren't quite familiar with, because the founder of this gallery, Hugh Lane, who was born in Cork in 1875, was an Irish art dealer who really wanted to gift a collection of paintings to the city of Dublin. And one of the main opponents was William Martin Murphy, who, of course, was a business magnate and really the instigator of the events that happened during the lockout in August 1913. And he was very much one of Lane's main antagonists and one of the main opponents, as I said, a very powerful opponent in terms of the establishment of a modern art gallery in Dublin. So the story is very much interlinked, and that's something that I've tried to show through our own permanent collection with over 70 works. And, of course, four works borrowed, including a portrait of William Martin Murphy.
Tell me about that portrait of Murphy, because I think it had been believed that William Orpen had, he'd been commissioned, I think, to paint Murphy. But when you went looking, you discovered the painting wasn't by him.
It's a very interesting portrait, and the way I have the paintings placed is Lane is at one end of the room looking down at William Martin Murphy, and then Larkin is looking at Martin Murphy on the wall beside him. And that portrait is very interesting because, naturally, we didn't have a portrait of William Martin Murphy in our collection. But apparently William Orpen had been commissioned by the Dublin Chamber of Commerce to paint a portrait of Martin Murphy, who was president of the Chamber of Commerce. And allegedly three portraits were produced. But when we borrowed this portrait from the Dublin Chamber of Commerce, we discovered that, in fact, it had been done by Margaret Clark, who was Orpen's assistant, studio assistant. So it wasn't by Orpen at all, but it is a direct copy of the portrait of William Martin Murphy. And the interesting thing about that is that William Orpen, during the lockout, had been working in the soup kitchens in Liberty Hall and helping the stricken workers. And then the following year, of course, he accepts a commission to paint William Martin Murphy. So obviously needs must in terms of an artist's career.
Margaret Clark married to Harry Clark. And then I think there's another portrait of William Martin Murphy in independent newspapers.
That's right. Apparently there are three versions, and the other copy, or the other version, which we presume is an Orpen as well, is it belongs to independent newspapers. Because, of course, William Martin Murphy owned independent newspapers. And this is the interesting thing, that he owned the Dublin Tramway Company. He also owned the Imperial Hotel and the independent newspapers. And he used the independent newspapers to publicise his antipathy towards Hugh Lane. And during 1913, starting in January, a string of vitriolic pieces by William Martin Murphy appeared in the paper. And also it explains why there isn't extensive coverage, visual coverage, of the events of the lockout in those newspapers too. And you had other journalists like Francis Sheehy Skeffington working as stringers for English newspapers, providing them with images of the lockout.
How political is the art here, or polemical, or is much of it polemical at all? Are we largely looking at portraits and, I suppose, representation of history unfolding, as opposed to people taking a particular political stance in their art?
Well, I think this exhibition, rather than being too portrait heavy, obviously there are portraits of the main protagonists involved in the lockout, but at the same time I have included scenes of Dublin, scenes of the citizens of Dublin. Many of them precede the lockout, some of them are slightly later, but they do evoke the period. Works by artists like William Orpen, who enjoyed wandering around the city and painting what he saw. Also Walter Osborne, who was very notable, and Sarah Purser for painting images of women and children, the people who were very stricken during the time of the lockout. So it gives, I suppose, a good representative collection. Now, obviously, with the artistic conventions of the time, the conflict that ensued during the lockout is not going to be the subject for artists. That sort of art simply would not sell. So what you're looking at is works by John Butler Yeats, we'll say, who, without being overly sentimental, does convey the sort of poverty that was very evident in the city at the time. And also in terms of artists like George Russell, I mean, George Russell was very concerned not only with the plight of the urban worker, but also the rural worker. And within our collection, too, we have a fantastic collection of works by Russell which depict the rural worker, because he worked tirelessly for the establishment of the cooperative movement in Ireland. And he saw it more or less as the plight of the worker, not only the worker in Dublin.
How significant a presence is William Butler Yeats and his father, John Butler Yeats, in this? I mean, I was looking at this, a lovely representations from the Abbey Theatre's tour to America. And it's I think, part of an effort to raise funds for the Municipal Art Gallery. There's a lovely piece by John Butler Yeats, which again, I suppose, very much speaks to the gallery here and the time and all of this.
Well, the interesting thing, of course, is that Hugh Lane was a nephew of Lady Gregory, and through Lady Gregory, who, of course, was a very close friend of W.B. Yeats and also heavily involved in the establishment of the Abbey Theatre. So Yeats, of course, was very familiar with the establishment and very involved with the establishment of the gallery, but also, and composed six poems that deal specifically with the Municipal Gallery, including that famous polemical poem from September 1913. Also, in terms of Yeats's involvement with the lockout, Yeats came to the lockout slightly later, and it was really clerical interference in the lockout through the Save the Kiddies scheme that really got Yeats very much involved in the lockout. Because he felt that this was a scheme that was established to send children of the workers abroad to England, and the clerics at the time caused uproar and said that they shouldn't go to heathen countries. So Yeats became involved with that and spoke about that publicly. And also he lamented, obviously, the fact that the middle classes of the time, including people like William Martin Murphy, had absolutely no interest in art and were much more commercially minded. And that was one of his main criticisms. Now, in terms of the Abbey Theatre's tour, that also was quite contentious, because within our collection, we have this piece of fabric that shows the Abbey players on tour in America in 1913. And at the top of it, it says that it was sold for $1 to fundraise money for the establishment of the art gallery. Now, apparently, many of the Abbey players weren't best pleased at the money from their tour being siphoned off for the establishment of an art gallery. And when the controversy surrounding the establishment of a permanent home location for the gallery grew more embittered towards the end of 1913, that money became the subject of litigation, with W.B. Yeats and Lady Gregory sort of at opposing views as to whether the money should be returned, and W.B. Yeats suggesting that independent litigation should decide whether the money should be returned in terms of the money gathered for the art gallery if it wasn't going to go ahead. And Lady Gregory was very annoyed with him about that, and quite exasperated with Hugh Lane at the same time, because of the fact that he was so single-minded in his pursuit of the art gallery that he failed to see, you know, the impact of tenement houses collapsing and the awful poverty in Dublin.
There are also a couple of lovely watercolours by Edwin Lutyens, these sketches for proposed gallery on Stephen's Green. They really caught my eye. They're quite beautiful.
Yeah. Well, this really is the crux of the matter, really, in terms of Hugh Lane. He had initially offered his collection to Dublin in 1904. 1913, you know, it's 9 years later, and still there's no permanent home. So he decided that he would commission a friend of his, a very well-known British architect called Edwin Lutyens, to produce a proposed design. And the suite of watercolours that we have are by William Walcott, and they are to Edwin Lutyens' design. The most famous proposal was to have a bridge across the River Liffey, replacing the unsightly metal bridge. And the other options considered were a site at St. Stephen's Green, which was quickly scuppered by Lord Ardilaun, who said that it was a public park and they didn't want that there. Also, a site at Merrion Square was also eliminated. But these beautiful watercolours show what it would have been like. And the ones that we have that show the bridge across the River Liffey absolutely are stunning works. But that idea was narrowly defeated by the city councillors, that idea of a bridge across the Liffey. And the reason being was because Lutyens was considered a British architect, even though his mother was Irish, and it was felt that it should be open competition for an Irish, you know, that an Irish architect should be able to compete for it. And also William Martin Murphy rode in as well in terms of that debate, and he claimed that putting a bridge across the Liffey would prevent fresh air from circulating through the slums of Dublin and thus promote disease. So completely outlandish. And also, I mean, just to show you the spectrum of people involved, George Bernard Shaw wrote gave a very whimsical interview in which he said, had Hugh Lane actually ever smelt the Liffey, because it would take the romance out of anything, the idea of a gallery across the River Liffey. So, and again, Shaw was very involved with the lockout too. So there's another crossover, and spoke at the Royal Albert Hall castigating the employers of Dublin. So when that proposal was defeated by the City Council, Lane had enough at that stage, and he decided to remove the paintings from Dublin and pursue his idea to give them to the National Gallery in London. And of course, this was covered in William Martin Murphy's independent newspapers, with photographs of the paintings thrown up on the back of a horse and cart as they leave the Mansion House. And him, and the caption is, you know, that there weren't any art lovers present to witness this departure.
There's a beautiful portrait of Hugh Lane, and it's actually quite moving now to consider that this, you know, 1913 is just 2 years before Lane dies on the Lusitania, and it's a very fine, evocative portrait of him.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to include, I mean, Lane is represented throughout, four times throughout the exhibition. I mean, we have the beautiful John Singer Sargent portrait that was commissioned in 1908, and again by public subscription, and presented to him in a hotel in Dublin in light of his contribution. But also we have another portrait by Mancini, an Italian artist, that, because not only was Lane collecting artworks for Dublin, he was also commissioning artists, living artists, to produce portraits. And then we have a beautiful portrait by Sarah Cecilia Harrison of Hugh Lane, a bearded Hugh Lane, one of the few showing him with a beard. And again, it's beautifully painted. And of course, Sarah Cecilia Harrison is another very important person in terms of the history of the gallery, because she was she was born in County Down. She was from an upper class background. She moved to Dublin in her early 20s and established herself as a very fine portrait painter, producing portraits of many, many individuals, important individuals in Dublin, and also portraits of women and children as well. And she became very involved not only in the lockout, she was also involved in the establishment of the gallery. So she actually became very politically active. She was the first female councillor elected to Dublin City Council, or Dublin Corporation as it was then, in 1912. She campaigned for the vote for women. She also established the allotment movement in Dublin, or the Land Cultivation Society, as it was known. And also she campaigned tirelessly for the plight of the poor and the plight of workers in Dublin. And at the same time, she wrote catalogue entries for the gallery as it was established in 1908 in its temporary premises in Clonmel House in Harcourt Street. And she, after Lane's untimely death in 1915, she continued the campaign. Now, the reason she's fallen slightly out fell slightly out of favour was because after Lane's death in 1915, she claimed that she had been engaged to him and that they had intended marrying later on in the summer. He died in May 1915. And this, she ended up alienating herself. There was no evidence to suggest that she just seemed to be infatuated with him. She was 12 years his senior. There was no evidence that there was anything romantic. And she ended up becoming quite estranged from Lane's family and from many other people, and she was referred to as mad. Now, I'm interested in her because I think that, you know, we can't take away from the fact that all the good work that she did in terms of fundraising, and also she tackled William Martin Murphy. I mean, they had a very bitter correspondence in the newspaper, and she actually went so far as to accost him outside his office on Dame Street one afternoon as he was leaving work.
remarkable story. And I suppose this must have been fascinating for you as well to discover so many of these stories in and through the art as you curated this exhibition, because as you talk, I mean, the whole world is coming back to light.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are several stories, and that it was a fascinating exhibition, and it shows the richness of the collection that we have here in the Hugh Lane. And, I mean, for example, there's another portrait that Sarah Cecilia Harrison did of Francis Sheehy Skeffington. And Francis Sheehy Skeffington, again, was quite an eccentric character. He was a vegetarian, campaigned for women's rights, very politically active, a journalist, and also became very involved in the lockout and also provided information to the British newspapers regarding what was going on in Dublin at the time. And also there's another interesting story about him in terms of actively being involved. I mean, he was working in the soup kitchens, and I mentioned the Save the Kiddies scheme. He was involved in that too. And Orpen actually tells an interesting story of one day he was in Liberty Hall with Jim Larkin, and they were waiting for Francis Sheehy Skeffington to come to bring some children down to Houston Station to be brought away for the Save the Kiddies scheme. And Francis Sheehy Skeffington didn't arrive on time, and Larkin said to Orpen, "Will you go instead?" And as Orpen was running down the stairs, he met Francis Sheehy Skeffington coming up, and he said, "No, I'll take the child." So off he went and arrived back several hours later without any clothes on, wrapped in a blanket and having been badly beaten up by members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. And Orpen says in his diary, "God, I could have got that, you know, sort of with relief." But it just, again, it shows, you know, how actively these people were involved, not only, you know, on a practical level, and also engaging with it intellectually and writing about the subject and trying to publicise it as well. And of course, Francis Sheehy Skeffington died then in 1916. He was executed simply because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That leads me to something else I wanted to ask you, which is, do many of the themes in this exhibition link to 1916? Obviously, you know, in a couple of years, we'll be looking at art around 1916 and the Rising, and then going on to War of Independence, Civil War. And I suppose it all must be part of a continuum. But I assume that here we're also looking at the bedrock of what will happen in a few years' time.
That's right. I mean, many of the people represented, including Porrick Pearce is included in this piece, were obviously key people in 1916. And also, I suppose, the whole debate surrounding the, you know, the Gaelic League and Douglas Hyde, all these people are included. And also, of course, Carson and Redmond are represented as well. And there we have two portraits by John Lavery that were presented to the collection. They were painted, and they were to hang side by side in a Dublin gallery. That was the stipulation by Lavery. So many of the individuals, Arthur Griffith, Edward Martin, Constance Markovich, they're all represented. So in a way, this exhibition sets the scene for the sort of commemorations that are going to come about in 3 years' time. And, of course, I suppose the interesting thing is as well to see how the scene had changed quite dramatically in the intervening period too.
Larkin and Connolly, I suppose, two of the people that we so strongly associate with this year and this period of history. What about representations of them and their presence in the exhibition?
Well, now, Larkin, we have a beautiful head portrait, a portrait of his head by Mina Carney, and that was commissioned by the Union later on. So I had that, and then I was obviously looking for a painting of Jim Larkin, and because we don't have one in our collection. And I ended up spotting a beautiful late pastel by Sean Keating of Jim Larkin that belongs to SIPTU, and they very kindly agreed to lend. And as I said, I've placed it so that he's looking directly up at William Martin Murphy. So it's great to have that representation. And similarly with James Connolly, it was quite a job to get a decent representation of Connolly. And the Irish Labour History Society lent us the Harry Kernoff images of Connolly, two images of Connolly, which show him in his Irish Citizens Army uniform, and also against the backdrop of Liberty Hall as it was then. So obviously they are very, you know, they're, it's great to have these representations. As I said, there aren't that many good paintings of Connolly in existence. And Larkin obviously is very powerful physically, you know, for in terms of an artist painting him, he has a very dramatic, and certainly the Sean Keating work with the blue piercing eyes and just the strength of his personality comes across very, very strongly in the work.
For you, do we get other insights to these characters, these people and the time from painting and from art as opposed to photography? I mean, obviously photography gives us quite a window of insight, but I suspect that something else that, you know, we can see, and it's not just about an individual perception or interpretation. Sometimes I think we can see perhaps a little bit more deeply into things and people through painting than we can necessarily in photographs.
Yeah, I think that definitely is the case, you know, and certainly looking at the representation and also looking at the people who painted these individuals. I mean, for example, the portrait of Arthur Griffith that we have is by Lily Williams, who came from a very strong unionist background, who really turned her back on her family to become, you know, to become friendly with Arthur Griffith and become, you know, again, quite politically active. So I think there's no doubt. And also there's a great small portrait of James Stephens as well, the writer, because, of course, he was George Russell's protege and, of course, provided the first, I suppose, most realistic account of life in tenement Dublin, coming from that background himself. And again, there's no doubt that I think, you know, the way people are presented it's much more evocative if you see it in a painting rather than just having a series of photographs of these individuals. You can convey so much more within a painting.
Eamonn O'Connor, tell me about this painting, Homage to Sir Hugh Lane by Sean Keating.
Fantastic piece of work, isn't it? It's huge. Well, in actual fact, it came about for a very unusual reason. In 1919, Keating was going to emigrate to America, and he knew Thomas Bodkin very well. And Thomas Bodkin actually commissioned this piece of work. He got him the job to do the Stations of the Cross in Clongowes College, and he commissioned this piece of work. And this piece of work hung in Thomas Bodkin's home until he died, and it was then bequeathed to the gallery here. And it is a homage to Hugh Lane, of course, with the Lutyens design over there in the right-hand side, Hugh Lane there in the background, and everybody involved with the whole issue of a new gallery for modern art, including W.B. Yeats, George Russell, fundamentally important to the whole thing. And of course it goes all the way back to the idea of the homage to Manet. So it's a very sort of classic representation. The interesting thing for me, because my interest in women artists too, is that Sarah Purser should really be in this painting, but she's not in the painting, but she is represented with the tablecloth. She did actually lend that tablecloth to the artist in order that he could, I suppose, paint her in, if you like. I know this from records that I've been reading too.
And
forever.
It is one of the more colourful details of the paintings.
It is, and you know, they cleaned the painting specially to put it into this exhibition. They've done a marvellous job on it. And as the tablecloth emerged, we were all fascinated because it was lost behind layers and layers of varnish for ages. But stunning painting that I'm nearly sure was done with separate individual photographs of all the sitters. They didn't
eight,
all come
eight
together.
Famous men eight, at the time,
yeah,
1920.
W.B. Yeats, George Russell, Colonel Hutchinson Poe, Richard Caulfield, Orpen.
And Hugh Lane as a portrait in the background.
Hugh Lane as a portrait, not looking very well. He's a bit green around the gills there, isn't he?
But he is.
He died in the Lusitania in 1915. So an extraordinary, very important piece of work, and huge for a private commission. Clearly, Bodkin was very interested in keeping Keating here in the country, which is why he did that. And then, of course, Keating didn't emigrate.
You're here today with a group of students from Trinity College. It's a terrific exhibition.
Oh, I love it. It's very difficult, and I think the curator here, Margarita, has really done so well. The fusion of the story of the Hugh Lane collection with the lockout, with the images, with the politics. It's a very difficult thing to do. She's done it so extraordinarily well. And there's a lovely little catalogue that goes with it. Beautiful essays. Really, really fantastic. Well worth seeing. So yeah, I've two groups of students today. I'll be here for the next 4 hours. I'm in my element. It's great.
And I think some of them learning part of their history as well as looking at the art.
Well, you see, I love exhibitions like this. Historical context, terribly, terribly important, particularly in Ireland, particularly before 1950, say. So something like this gives somebody like me, an art historian like me, great fun and a great opportunity to get them thinking about the fact that artists did not work in splendid isolation no more than poets or writers or whatever at the time. It's very important.
This portrait of James Larkin by Sean Keating, a much older Larkin than would we'd associate with 1913.
That's right, a lovely jowly-faced Larkin, isn't he fab? Lovely blue eyes. I love the way Keating uses the chalk pastel here. It's very Orpin-esque in its treatment of the skin tones, this sort of movement of colour all around. Beautiful, really stunning portrait. Done in the late 40s or early 1950s, in fact.
Yeah, look at that.
Beautiful.
So we hear an awful lot about Countess Markievicz working for the poor, and rightly so. But somebody like Sarah Cecilia Harrison has sort of disappeared from the history of Irish art, which is an awful shame, because she did work so hard. An extraordinary woman, elected to Dublin Corporation, date like 1912. Extraordinary.
This lovely self-portrait from 1889.
Beautiful, isn't it? Very, very classical, very lovely, very frank. Really kind of Vermeer-esque, isn't it? Really. Lovely. But, you know, we hear about Sarah Purser, and rightly so. And we hear about the Countess, and rightly so. But then there are always people that slip away, and that's one of the great things about this exhibition. It brings those personalities back to life, which is fantastic, I think.
Dr. Margarita Capuch and Emer O'Connor there at the Dublin City Gallery, the Hugh Lane in Parnell Square in Dublin. You're listening to Arts Tonight, our topic, the arts and commemoration, lockout and revolution in Ireland. Back in a moment.
RTE Radio 1.
Our guests on Arts Tonight, Catriona Crowe, Theo Dorgan and Paul Rouse, were discussing some of the exhibitions, songs, books and plays that remembered the general strike and lockout of 1913 and those turbulent years of unfolding history in Ireland. Theo, I suppose, as well as the various acts of witness at the time, there have been many books, plays, songs since that have looked back at these times. I mean, I often think of Paddy Galvin's song about Connolly and the new book, Songs of Freedom, and Paddy Galvin's wonderful song, James Connolly.
Who mourns the death of this brave man?
It reminds me of something Frank Hart used to say: the winners write the histories, the losers write the songs.
Oh, bury me down in yon green garden.
One of the things that these commemorations is bringing up is that there are two counterposed histories and they feed into each other. Ideally, they should feed in. There's the stubborn memory of the people, which is very often encapsulated in songs, and the version of history that the ordinary people retain is always retained in songs. Nora Connolly O'Brien says that, for instance, and she's right. And then there's the official professional history. We're living in a fortunate time because, as Paul has just said, the best of our historians now are looking to the actual memories of the people. They're looking to private correspondence, they're looking to parish records, they're looking to songs and stories, they're looking to the poems and paintings of a period to get a more holistic view rather than a didactic, professorial, or in the old sense, view. And that's a good thing.
Catriona, Margarita Capuch said there that she believes art can help us see the past more clearly. And perhaps it sometimes gives us a more oblique view than standard historical narratives. And I suppose it often helps us to remember significant figures like Sean O'Casey's sister Bella in Mary Morrissey's new novel, The Rising of Bella Casey, or the patron activist Sarah Cecilia Harrison. Figures who really seem to have been undervalued in our official history.
Yeah, I mean, something we shouldn't forget to talk about is Strumpet City,
absolutely,
for example.
Yep.
You know, that really was the first outing, and it was 1969, I think, when it was published. Took Plunkett 11 years to write it. That has spawned The Risen People and a whole bunch of other things, and of course, very cleverly was made the One City, One Book by Dublin City Council this year.
Well, one of my favourite moments from the year was Mike Finn's 3-minute version of Strumpet City, originally delivered by David Norris at the Zebby Awards. Here's David Hurley with a kind of digested listen.
The King of England rocks up in his yacht with his mot looking hot. Children in rags wave flags, women swoon, men doff their hats, while in Dublin's fair city people shiver in flats with rats. The king comes ashore in a punt, Rashers Tierney pushes to the front. "I declare to Jesus," says he, "the king looks like a tough, and he's a dead ringer for Peter Ustinov." And he fingers his tin whistle in his pocket. Up in the big house, Mary is a maid. She gets paid, but wants to get laid. Fitz works hard in a yard, has a union card. Fitz gets his jollies, Mary gets the sack. She leaves Kingstown, never coming back. There's a strike at the docks, someone throws rocks. Jim Larkin stands on a box. Workers cheer, bosses sneer. Ladies eat their luncheons, policemen finger their truncheons. Larkin's voice is clear and loud. Rashers Tierney pushes through the crowd. "I declare to Jesus," says he, "and yes, can call me a fool, but doesn't the bowel Jim Larkin look like Peter O'Toole?" And he fingers his tin whistle in his pocket. Larkin is arrested, Larkin is released. Mary marries Fitz in front of a priest. They live in a crammed tenement with one toilet and two sinks. The place stinks. Father O'Connor shows up with a suitcase full of pity. He wants to look after the poor of the city. He feeds them and needs them to save them from hell, but goes back to Dunleary cos he can't stand the smell. Rashers then asks Fitz if he's seen the Irish RM on the box. "I declare to Jesus, you're the head off Flurry Knox." Rashers gets a job on the boiler in the church, but he gets drunk, plays his whistle and leaves them in the lurch. The church freezes. The baby Jesus sneezes. Father O'Connor gives Rashers the sack. Father Giffley brings him back. "The blessings of God on you," says Rashers. "I just want to play me music," before telling Father Giffley he's the spit of Cyril Cusack. There's a massive lockout. The whole city wobbles. Trams stop. Jackboots pound on cobbles. Horses shy, women cry, blood flows and bullets fly. The whole city appears in slow motion. Rashers Tierney surveys the commotion. "There's drama and passion, and after having a luke, I declare to Jesus this'd make a great book." Then he catches his reflection in the window of Cleary's and thinks, "Maybe a mini-series. And I declare to Jesus, am I a dead ringer for your man out of Wagon Ned?" A few days later, he turns up dead in his hovel. But that's not the end of the novel. No, it goes on for ages. 549 pages. But to long-winded speechifying, you have an aversion. So this has been Strumpet City, the 3-minute version.
David Hurley there with Mike Finn's 3-minute version of Strumpet City. Actually, I was thinking about Strumpet City, Paul, in relation to love-hate and the power of television and film to, I suppose, to show life as it is, and we don't always get to see that.
Well, I think the interesting thing about Strumpet City is that it's not a work of sentimentality, it's not a work of propaganda, and it's a very fair book. But I would argue that the only thing in the book that I would criticise is the manner in which Larkin is portrayed. I think Larkin is given a bit of an easy ride in the book, that I know he was a hero to the people, and I absolutely understand the iconic legend of sacrifice that he stood for. But he also was a megalomaniac who, it was ultimately about Larkin, and that revealed itself over time more freely. Whereas in Strumpet City, Plunkett, who originally worked with Larkin for a year and must have been influenced by that, he doesn't quite do that.
But he might also be giving himself a get-out-of-jail-free card by keeping him out of the book, so he doesn't have to concentrate on the terrible rows with Connolly
Absolutely.
And O'Brien.
That's fair.
Which we all know. I mean, Connolly really got pissed off with him several times. So that's there, and maybe that was a way of using him artistically for the purpose he was needed for in the book without having to investigate. In other words, the imagination does strange things to history.
Speaking of imagination to us, was another figure we shouldn't forget in relation to all this is James Stephens.
Yes.
And the power
yes.
of what Stephens achieved
exactly
as well.
Exactly what Catherine is describing there as an effect of Strumpet City. I remember a microcosm of that in The Charwoman's Daughter, which I read when I was a young teenager and was very moved by. growing up in Cork, what I knew of Dublin couldn't have been written on a postage stamp. I suffered at the time from that insular self-sufficiency of the Cork mind. And
don't be too hard on yourself there.
No, it's a particular version of it. I mean, there was a very cosmopolitan Cork as well, which most of us came out of. But that sense of powerlessness and of the size of what was ranged against a single poor woman, a single poor child, that was a wake-up call for me. But that aside, and I'm glad, by the way, that we've come to a point where we can look at heroic figures, and Larkin was a heroic figure, in the round, and see them with their flaws and not feel that somehow the existence of a flaw cancels either achievement or stature. You mentioned love-hate. That's a version of how a contemporary storytelling style can be brought to bear on Ireland, but it's an imported style. I don't believe, given the genius of what's happening in some aspects of Irish theatre at the moment, I don't believe it would be impossible for RTE to sit down and talk to some of our key dramatists and put them in a collective with poets and musicians and singers and historians and say, can we imagine a different way of celebrating the centenary of the Rising? Can we do it differently in a way that nobody has ever thought of before? It's possible. Whether the will is there, that's the question.
This is something I want to ask you all. You know, looking forward to this decade of anniversaries, 1916, you know, the centenary coming up, Civil War, War of Independence. All you know, we're looking at a long period of looking back, and I suppose what we have to consider is how imaginative an approach may be within the arts, within the media, to, I suppose, both honouring the past and questioning it and throwing light. And if you look at the work of people like Mick O'Dea, the painter, I suppose what Robert Ball has been doing for a long time and what others have been engaged with as well. And it is going to be a very interesting time for artists as well as historians and as well as commentators, you know, to face the past and maybe try to both reveal something and challenge something. You know, Paul, when you look at these years ahead, and do you does your heart lift, or do you worry slightly that, you know, we may spend too long looking back?
I look at it with excitement. I believe things will happen, and I don't think you can say what will happen. I think people will move to do things that will be unique. You talk about insurrection. There's a great story to be told on Enniscorthy from 1916, the town which rose most of all. And wouldn't it be wonderful if Colm Tobin was to take that story with its vast array of characters in it, extraordinary people in the town which was also a major centre for recruitment for the British Army. If you could imagine how that town was split apart and pulled asunder across that week in April 1916. And if you talk about James Stephens wrote a brilliant book, Insurrection in Dublin, which is a story, his diary written, published in May 1916, telling his eyewitness account of the story. And that itself could be dramatised quite brilliantly. There is stuff in that book,
or
about
even just republished.
Republished, mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is stuff in it. It's the detail in that book, the sweet shop being looted. Who loots a sweet shop during a revolution?
Everybody.
The poor.
It's everyone. it's the dead horse lying at the corner of Stephen's Green in a pool of blood, having had its throat slit. So it's both brutal and brilliant at the same time. And it, how do people go back and look at that? Okay, one way is the republication of these works that were published at the time and published in the 60s. But people need to look anew at it. I mean, in Century Ireland, we've tried to do that to incorporate, I suppose, the poetry of the period as well as everything else. It was an amazing thing to go through the newspapers and see September 1913 in the Irish Times, published right in the midst of the conflict.
Mm-hmm. An extraordinary idea, that. And obviously, Katrina, you know, all those, you know, stories, old stories to be told that mm-hmm. have not been told.
Well,
republication,
yeah.
and new things to be made.
Part, I suppose, I know archives is not really what we're talking about, but unless we have the archives out there for people to see and understand and make up their own minds about and have proper public access to them, we simply won't know what actually happened. And we still don't, because there are large tranches of material that are still not available to people. Now, that would be one of my missions, and Paul's and Century Ireland's, for the decade. But I mean, I suppose one looks at it, I would anyway, with a mixture of trepidation and excitement, in the sense that what we're looking at is a very turbulent decade that's characterised largely by death. you know, 30,000 Irishmen died in World War One, which was the most murderous war ever seen on the planet up to that point. We have the deaths in 1916, the War of Independence, and then we have a vicious civil war from which it could be argued the country still hasn't recovered. So we have a lot of interrogating to do of all of that, of the militaristic atmosphere that pervaded Europe at the time that we were part of, how all that worked. I think the arts can play a huge role in that because, and I want to echo Theo's call for getting people together who are artists to try to reimagine all of this in the light of fresh information, in the light of their own imaginations.
And on that thought, we must leave it. Thanks to Katrina Crowe, Theo Dorgan and Paul Rouse. Divided Dublin continues at the Hugh Lane Dublin City Gallery until February the 2nd next year. Songs of Freedom, the James Connolly songbook, is published by PM Books. There's also a CD, Songs of Freedom, by the Songs of Freedom Band, also issued by PM. And on next week's programme, Language and Literature, Alan Titley with an alternative literary atlas of Ireland and remembering the late academic Bob Welch. Join us then. Till next Monday, goodbye.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions. And you can listen back to that edition of Arts Tonight on the RTE radio player, available online at rte.ie. The programme is repeated on Wednesday mornings at 4 through the night, and you can podcast it too on our website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight.